A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, folks. We are back. It's another Miami Midway update podcast because Miami continues to be Miamiing. It feels like it's been going on quite a long time. There's still quite a lot of it to go. David's here. Hello, David.
Hello.
Okay, good chat, David. Good chat. Matt's here. Hello, Matt.
I'm into Miami,
hello,
as you can tell.
How are you?
I'm right. David, folks, has been up since 3 a.m. Today. He claims he got back to sleep and had a bit of supplementary sleep on top of that. But basically, he woke up at 3 a.m. and watched the deciding set of Casper Ruud and Alexander Zverev. So while he'll be able to give detailed analysis of the final set of that match, he might not be firing on all cylinders in other departments.
Short on chat.
So make it a really excellent description, David, of that deciding set. Go.
Okay. Well, I think I can because I found it very interesting. I joined it with Casper Ruud having just lost the second set 6-1 and he's having extensive treatment to his foot. Turns out all for blisters and he needed it retaped. Now, I think as well after losing the set 6-1, there probably is a bit of reboot going on. But he said once he got out there again in the third set, it immediately loosened up and boy did it because he raced into a 3-love lead in that third set and it was like he went through a mental reboot as well because he clearly decided to just go for it and take it to Zverev. And that I thought that rocked Zverev back on his heels. And I thought that's a bit of a trend in Zverev's career. If you can stand up to him, I was thinking it reminded me quite a lot of elements of that Denis Shapovalov match that Zverev lost at the Australian Open. Somebody stands up to him, what's Zverev going to do about it? And he went in, I felt he went passive, he went into his shell. The serve is not as reliable as it was last year. He was down at 67% first serves in for the match, which it's okay, but we've seen matches where he's at 80%, several matches in a row. And Ruud was explosive. It was the biggest win that he's ever had in ranking. And it was on a hard wow. court. You know, and he's reached three other Masters 1000 clay court semis, but he's never reached a hard court one. He's never beaten Zverev before. He'd played him twice and he'd lost both of them in straight sets. One of them, you know, quite close sets, but he'd always looked like somebody who just on a hard court doesn't have the weight of shot, doesn't have the comfort on the surface, and Zverev does. And this was totally different. He was just going after it. And it was very interesting to watch. And the same thing happened when Ogier Aliassim beat Zverev at the start of the year in the ATP Cup. He went for it. And there's a theme developing there that if you can do that, if you can get enough returns back in and push him on the back foot, he doesn't like it. And he doesn't have necessarily the response to come through.
And I would add Tommy Paul into that list of players who've taken it to Zverev and beaten him. Tommy Paul did that in Indian Wells a couple of weeks ago. And actually, Zverev's not having a great year results-wise. You mentioned the Shapovalov. That was a straight sets loss in the third round of the Australian Open. Bublik beat him in the Montpellier final. Another guy who has the capability to just take it to you and sort of be really aggressive and take the racket out of your hand. And I think all of these players have done that to Zverev and he's not responding. I think he's had too much success playing a style of tennis that actually doesn't suit him. You know, he's had too much success kind of grinding away behind the baseline in these big matches, and that isn't the style that best suits him. He's best when he's on the front foot being aggressive, but he lapses into that other style so much, and I think players are really learning to take advantage of that now.
Yeah, he's far better at being a grinder than a 6'6" bloke with his weapons has any right to be. He's all right at it, but that's not the game that's going to win him Grand Slams.
That's it, isn't it? It's a ceiling.
And winning
it.
Grand Slams is what he's here for, isn't it? It's not a good year for him, is it? I go back to that Australian Open that, as you pointed out, Matt, it was the nature of that loss. Straight sets, not even close to Denis Shapovalov, who also not having a good year. Who did Shapovalov lose to this week? It was, you know, almost a week ago, I think, that happened.
Lloyd Harris, I think it was.
Lloyd Harris.
We even got that into one of our other update shows because it was so early in the tournament. And just on Zverev as well, and I may be stretching this too far, but it did occur to me during this match how quiet he was. And I do wonder whether in the back of his mind is, I can't afford to get out of line. I can't afford to lose my temper. Because, you know, one unsportsmanlike code of conduct and he is going to be banned. And I wonder whether that makes him inhibited as a tennis player. But, you know, he's certainly, there were points last year when he would impose himself on matches and it's almost as though he'd twigged that I have to put away this grinding from behind the baseline. But I'm sure it comes down to confidence, because when you start getting rattled, when you lose confidence, you go back into whatever comfort zone you have, whatever baseline level and standard game you feel comfortable with. And his serve is not functioning the way he wants it to, and he was not playing aggressive tennis. So, yeah, I think there's... And Clay isn't necessarily going to be the answer for him. Rude was worthy of that win today, really was.
Rocky old year for the new big three.
Is Nadal not part of what he said it would be?
No, David.
Medvedev.
Goodness, no. Forget Nadal. Medvedev, Djokovic and Zverev is the new big three, we're told. Medvedev, I think, is really motivated to get back to number one, isn't he? He doesn't want to be the guy that had number one for a couple of weeks and lost it, does he? He doesn't want to be Pat Rafter or Yevgeny Kafelnikov, does he? With those two are obviously great players, but he wants to be, you know, okay, he's never going to achieve the numbers of Novak Djokovic. I wouldn't have thought, but he wants to be an established, long-term, dominant world number one, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so. And it does feel like motivation is the right word. I think there was probably some sort of pressure before to get to number one. He was in such a good position. He'd never been there. Now he has at least had a couple of weeks there. Now he's just motivated to get it back and keep it. And he's one match away from doing that. If he beats Hubert Hurkacz tonight to make it into the semifinals, he will be the new world number one when the rankings come out next week, going into the clay court season. And I think he's played pretty well this week, Medvedev, for a surface that I don't think he loves. I think it's a bit slow and a bit high bouncing for him. It's not his favourite. He has to adjust, but he's so good at doing that. And I thought his match against Brooksby was interesting. Two of the more unorthodox players on the ATP Tour, just their stroke production, what they look to do with the tennis ball is interesting. And Medvedev was a breakdown in that first set, but stayed calm, got it back, and then really, really took over. And I think he's in quite a good place. But it's a tight head-to-head he's got with Hurkacz. All of their matches have been close. And obviously Hurkacz does like these conditions in Florida. So, yeah, interesting. There's a lot on this match tonight for Medvedev, because if he doesn't get it back now, he's not going to love the clay court season. Obviously, he's got lots of points he can make up on the clay court season, but, you know, it's not his favourite time of year, as we know.
Good title defence from Hubert Hurkacz, isn't it, so far? Pretty impressed by that, actually, because he doesn't strike me as the sort of character that would love, you know, that would puff his chest out and go, this is my turf, I'm the defending champion here, this is my title to lose. But he's just quietly having a really good title defense, and I, you know, good on him for that. And that head-to-head against Medvedev is interesting. I still think just call off the whole competition because Alcaraz is in it. He looks to me like he's playing a different sport to everyone else. We were all in a WhatsApp chat yesterday, the three of us with my brother, which was sparked because David was seeking the right audience to reveal that he had hit an underarm serve in a friendly doubles match at his local club the night before. And I love the thought process, David, that you thought, I could just tell Matt and Catherine, but I might not quite get the appreciation that I need from this. So I'll go into the Kirioptimists chat, which isn't called that at the moment. Goodness knows what it's called. And
it's called Kirio, not this again now.
Oh, yes. That feels appropriate. And you did get the reaction you wanted from a different Whittaker.
Actually, I you're right. I did deliberately put it in that chat. And I did it because I thought he might give me a bit of backup, because I thought I was going to get some stick from you, and I was right. In fact, there was some fallout of words. But I thought your brother is the kind of Kirioptimist who just appreciates the ambition and the nerve and the sheer audacity to go for a shot like that in a rubbish Tuesday night doubles match at Henley and Arden.
It's the doubles of it all that I take issue with. I think you're just setting up your partner to get smacked in the chest, basically. P.S. folks, it didn't make it over the net, so we'll never know.
No. Also, it's a lot harder than you think, actually.
Wasn't it contrary to everything you believe about the underarm serve that it should be a tactical thing?
Mm.
You said you did it on a whim.
Matt's first question was, how far behind the baseline were they standing to receive?
Yeah.
David was didn't even clock that.
Well,
irrelevant.
I mean, the truth is, I did literally think of hitting it a second before I did it. And I've thought about it in the past. One day I'm going to hit an underarm serve. I've never done it before in a situation like that. And I was playing the lad who's only about 15, but he's by far the best player on the night. Like, he's the best player in the whole club. And I thought, I'm just going to do it. And so I tried to do one of those sort of side spin, back spin efforts, you know, and I didn't really catch it properly, and it went into the bottom of the net. And then we changed ends, and I actually held serve. We changed ends, and then he's serving to me, and he tries one as revenge. And his was worse than
mine.
He kind of tried to go for also a side spin one, and he kind of hit the frame of the racket, and it went off at a sort of 45-degree angle the wrong way. Anyway, so that was my night.
This sounds like appalling tennis.
It wasn't great, I have to say.
Anyway, you got the desired response from Matthew Whittaker. Who said the normalisation campaign starts in Henley and Arden?
Quite right, yes.
Of the underarm serve. Anyway, but with the chat evolved into talking about Carlos Alcaraz, and Math said it looks like he's a player sent from the future, sent back from the future. He said it's like if you dropped Nadal into tennis in 1975, and that clicked with me. I thought, yes, that does feel like what I'm watching. This is just, it's just different gravy. It makes me gasp all the time, and it feels like he gets better with every match. Now, I'm not saying he's not susceptible still. He's still 18 years old. You know, he could have a lapse in concentration. He could have a bad day. I don't know. But his top level seems to me so much higher than, I mean, his medium level seems so much higher than anything else I'm watching at the moment. Am I too aboard the hype train, David? Surely not. I mean, you think he's going to win the French Open. You're
driving
the hype train.
You seem to think he's never going to lose again.
Well, when you watch him, it's hard to imagine him losing. I watched it with my own eyes 2 weeks ago to Nadal, but that took a feat of, you know, classic Nadal, mind over matter, you will not break my will. And that is the greatest will the sport has ever seen. It, of course he's going to lose again. Could lose really soon. But when you watch him, I'm thinking, well, how can he ever lose?
Well, watching that match back, I watched it the next morning, but I did it on one of the catch-up services where you see the duration of the match quite irritatingly on Tennis TV. It's a great service generally, but they show that the match was 2 hours long. And so I'm just watching it, and I kind of feel like you get to a certain point in the match, you know how it's going to end. And Tsitsipas went up 5-2. And frankly, he was in the other service games that Alcaraz held as well. He was really putting pressure on. It reminded me very much of the way he took on Jannik Sinner at the Australian Open. He intended to go out there and show this kid a thing or two. And he imposed himself. And he was brilliant for 20 minutes. I thought Alcaraz is, I don't want to say getting found out here, but he had somebody stand up to him and impose a game on him that he was struggling to live with, I felt, just in that first 25 minutes. But his ability to turn that around without Tsitsipas's level noticeably dropping dramatically, I think it did in the second set, but I think he was so shaken by the seven-game run that Alcaraz went on, which included probably one of the best tweeners I've ever seen, where he got lobbed volleyed and he got all the way from the net back to the backstop when he's at point blank range and still managed to hit a through the legs tweener lob, which then extracted a tweener attempt from Tsitsipas. Amazing feat. But he did this several times. The quicksilver nature of his footwork to get back, his touch on the lob, his touch on the drop shot, and the sheer violence of his ground strokes, forehand and backhand. It's just astonishing to witness what he's able to do. And Tsitsipas couldn't respond. It was very similar in that way to their US Open match. These gasps from the crowd, this look on Tsitsipas's face, as if to say, what am I up against here? This isn't normal. And I don't know. I can only say it feels like watching young Nadal. And how many times have I said that already? And he hasn't even done much yet. So it's him against Medvedev is a match I cannot wait to see if it happens, because it's just another indication for us of where we are. Where is he? Where does he stand? Because Medvedev's not going to be having it, is he? He's going to believe that he's got the game to tangle him up, sort him out, make him malfunction. Can't wait.
Just writing off the challenge of Hubert Hurkacz and Miomir Kecmanovic there, David.
Well, I mean,
who is standing in the way of that
so
meeting.
Well, I mean, though,
isn't he?
It's going to
Do you
be
know
great
what he is,
see.
David? Do you know what he is?
No.
He's agricultural.
I do. I'm very impressed with Kecmanovic. He is really improved.
Yeah, where's that come from? Any theories, Matt? Is it Nalbandian?
I think so.
I've got the where has Kecmanovic come from question.
He's all loaded up for his Alcaraz.
You're also about to get the Cirundolo question.
That
so,
one I can do. I can do that one. Well, the thing is, he's been with Nalbandian for a while now. You know, it's not like Nalbandian came in the off-season.
But they've really stuck with it, haven't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, and I think that's
there
something.
There were some dodgy results when Nalbandian first came on board.
Yeah, I think that's something. I think so many players quit on a coach early. You've surely got to give these things time. And Kecmanovic really has had a fantastic start to the season, and I totally did not see this coming. I thought Kecmanovic had been around enough now that we knew
yeah,
who he was.
We knew who he was, totally.
Yeah, and he beat Taylor Fritz the other night, and I think Taylor Fritz was a little bit out of gas. He just looked like he'd reached the end of his winning streak. He'd just come to the end. But Kecmanovic has been winning a lot of matches recently as well. So for him to still be sort of physically going, I think is impressive. And look, I think Alcaraz will beat him because, as you said, I agree with all the things you've just said about Alcaraz and that top level being just mind-boggling at the moment, and he's finding that top level repeatedly. But, you know, that wouldn't be a bad loss for Kecmanovic if he does lose to Alcaraz, because, as you said, everyone bar Nadal is losing to Alcaraz at the moment.
So those are the two quarterfinals yet to be played in the top half of the draw. We've got Medvedev, Hurkacz, and Alcaraz, Kecmanovic. In the bottom half of the draw, they are a step ahead, because, you know, it would be ridiculous if we all just knew where we were with the various draws in the Miami Open. It must be a confusing situation. So in the bottom half of the draw, they're a step ahead, and we've got a semi-final already set up between Casper Ruud, as discussed, and Francisco Cerúndolo, who, along with his brother, have pack-hunted that bottom half of the draw. Juan Manuel Cerúndolo, poor old Francis Tiafoe, is in a hall of mirrors where everyone is a Cerúndolo.
Yeah, they've pack-hunted him out of the draw. Juan Manuel couldn't quite do it. Francisco finished him off. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of lines, of stats, which should have illustrate what an incredible run this is for Francisco Cerúndolo. I mean, if we go back a year, pretty much, that was when we first discovered not only that there was one Cerúndolo, but that there were two. And it was actually Juan Manuel who, I think, came to everyone's attention first, because he won Cordoba, I think, as a wild card, out of nowhere. And then the next week, another Cerúndolo, Francisco Cerúndolo, reached the final of Buenos Aires. So they did these two great things back-to-back last year. And they've been solid since then, but pretty quiet, nothing spectacular. And Francisco Cerúndolo has now reached the semi-finals here, having never previously won an ATP match on a hard court. That's extraordinary. He'd never even won a match at a 250 event or a 500 event. He's now reached the semis of Miami. He'd never played a Masters 1000 on any surface, and he's into the semi-finals here. So he's the first player to reach the semi-final of a Masters 1000 without playing one before, since Jerzy Janowicz in Paris in 2012, who of course went on to reach the final. That's in the ATP media notes. And he's the lowest ranked Miami men's semi-finalist in the tournament's history, at 103 in the world right now. And, you know, he's beaten Monfils, he's beaten Opelka, and he obviously took advantage of Sinner's blisters yesterday, and Sinner couldn't finish the match after five games. He retired. But yeah, he's got a big game. I think Juan Manuel is more your traditional clay courter, but Francisco's got power. He can really take the ball on. And yeah, it's a pretty incredible run, and obviously it's a big chance for Casper Ruud in that semi final more than anything. But you would have to say it's a big chance for Cerúndolo as well, because Ruud's never got to a Masters 1000 final either. So opportunity knocks for both of them, I think.
He did well with his Cerúndolo section, didn't he, David? We're off the hook.
He did better than me the other day, because I was watching another match when Francis Tiafoe on the tennis TV feed came onto the court, and I thought, who's he playing? Oh, Cerúndolo. I tell you what, I'll leave that and get on with what I'm doing. So I kind of left that one to go. And an hour and a half later, Tiafoe had won. He's through. And then the next day, I see Tiafoe against Cerúndolo on the kind of multi-choice platform. And I'm looking at this, I'm thinking, I'm sure this has already happened. They've got something wrong here. And then sure enough, he carries on and he loses to him. I'm thinking, can you have a lucky loser in the middle of a draw? I mean, I know I've got long COVID, but, and this brain fog is causing me some issues, but I mean, this is just too much if I'm getting this. And then I looked up the draw and realised there's two of them. I know we've had this a year ago where you introduced us to it, Matt, but I'd clean forgotten. But Manuel, I think, is ranked about 128 in the world. So it's very, very interesting. There's 3 years between them, but very similar rankings. And yeah, it will be fascinating to see how they end up going from here, really.
Which one's going to have the better career, Matt?
Ooh, what a question.
Another great question. I'm going to say Francisco with confidence.
That is recency bias, isn't it? Right, okay. does Francisco stand a chance against Casper Ruud?
Yeah, I think he does stand a chance, given the players he's beaten. I think Ruud will win, but yeah, stands a chance. He's the best Cerundolo brother.
In the Cerundolo rankings, he is number one. Okay, well, Casper Ruud against Francisco Cerundolo, that's a semi-final. So that'll be played in a couple of days' time. So you've got a couple of days before that prediction potentially goes out of date, Matt. One last thing, unfortunately, to cover before we move on to the women's draw is it is Nick Kyrgios and what happened in his fourth round match, or was it a quarter? No, it was a fourth round match, wasn't it, against Jannik Sinner, which he lost in two straight sets. And yet, Jannik Sinner was very, very good and a very deserving winner. But of course, it was ended up not being about that. It ended up being about what was going down the other end of the court, which was Nick Kyrgios receiving point penalties, game penalties, I hope fines subsequently. He was abusive, in my opinion, towards umpire Carlos Bernardes. And just like he did in Indian Wells, has doubled down on it in his press conference rather than sort of saying, you know, heat of the moment, I wish I hadn't said those things, but I did. He's, you know, been taken aback that he's even being asked to explain himself for his behaviour towards the umpire, who he said some pretty, well, not pretty, he said some ghastly things towards, in my opinion, Carlos Bernardes. Said after the match, I got frustrated. Can't I get frustrated? I think Carlos Bernardes doesn't know how to control the crowd well. Everyone will have their opinion. I just think my penalty was not deserved. And he posted on Twitter to a similar effect, actually an even stronger effect. His tweet ended with hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line. That was the decision he made because the umpire's feelings got hurt. And then in caps, get new people. I mean, I think this is really appalling, like horrible. He seems to be calling for the entire profession of umpiring to be sort of sacked and replaced with people like him. I don't know. I mean, I really resent that we're having to talk about this, but we are having to talk about this. It was really unpleasant, I thought, and this is the absolute worst of Nick Kyrgios, and it's horrible. And the fact that he doubles down on it when he's not in the heat of the moment, I find pretty unforgivable, really, because his defence is, oh, it's the heat of the moment. Am I not allowed to get frustrated in the heat of the moment? But he, you know, he seems incapable of apologising or admitting fault. And I think that's fundamentally what's happening here. When he knows he's going to lose, when he gets into a stage of a tennis match where he realises his tennis isn't good enough, he finds something else to be the reason or the distraction or the cause of the fact that he's losing, because he can't handle it.
Yeah, well, I feel an idiot because I was talking about how dialed in he looked the other day and how a good place he looked, and I think overall he is in one of his better spells. But you're right, I mean, I talked about Ruud standing up to Zverev, and that was what Sinner did here. He just stood up to him games wise and stayed with him and pushed him to breaking point, and yeah, he then rails against whatever's in front of him, and that's the umpire in this case. And look, I sometimes like a fallout with an umpire if it's fun. You actually put it into good words for me the other day. You said the difference is this was mean, the way he was behaving. It was, and in isolation,
and really personal.
The thing that he was reprimanded by the umpire for saying something to Kyrgios's friend about the umpire. And in isolation, you might say, well, is that big a deal? But it wasn't just that. He'd been baiting him. He'd been saying stuff continuously to try to get a reaction. And it Honestly, I loved that Carlos Bernardes stood up to him and just wasn't having it. Just wasn't having it. Regardless of the detail, I'm just not having this. And he stood up to him. The stuff he wrote on Twitter, I think there's maybe grounds for the ATP having a look at what he wrote on Twitter there. And also, I have sympathy and empathy with Kyrgios for the mental health struggles that he's talked to us about, and I'm glad that he was open about them. But then he goes and starts talking about an umpire like that. Oh, your feelings were hurt, were they? You know, mocking him. What? You can't have it. You can't just have it for yourself, Nick. Other people do have feelings, actually, and treat them like human beings. I do sometimes wonder, how would Everett reacted around in McEnroe's day if we were doing the tennis podcast 30 years ago? And it's 40 years ago now, but I think I'd feel similarly. I would hate this feeling that McEnroe used to give umpires, and this feeling of bullying, and this, it's just awkward. And this is somebody I get on very well with in recent years in his post career, McEnroe. But yeah, there's a feel that I can't be doing with, and Kyrgios provided that again, and I think we are seeing his limits really yet again, and sooner or later at these big events, he's likely to run into somebody who can handle his tennis, and then it becomes a mental battle.
Yeah, well said. I agree with all of that. This incident reminded me of something Kyrgios himself actually said at Indian Wells when he was being heckled in the front row. He said, oh, I'd never tell Ben Stiller how to do his job, so you don't tell me how to do mine. The very next tournament, he's spending a whole match telling Carlos Bernardes how to do his job and how to umpire. It is the worst Kyrgios trait, and this is not a one-off. He's constantly horrible to umpires. We've talked about it before. He's constantly putting them down or saying that they're only doing things for attention. No, he's the one doing things for attention, and he's the one treating them badly. And I can handle a lot of the Kyrgios stuff. I'm on board with a lot of the Kyrgios stuff. The umpire treatment is his worst thing, and it's a pattern. And yeah, I hate it. I really do. And the fact that he doubles down on it in his press conference after and can't even admit any fault whatsoever, I think is really poor and disappointing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Well, he's out of the tournament. Clay courts to come. Interesting to see how much even plays on the clay.
Oh, he's surprised to see him. He's not playing any. Not playing right. The French Open. Not going to bother.
Okay. All right. See you at Wimbledon, Nick. The Special K's are still in the tournament, though, so tennis is safe.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, tennis podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
On to the women's draw, where Iga Świątek is very much playing like the new world number one and like somebody that is just saying, okay, I'm number one now. You shall all bow to me. And by bow to me, I mean lose to me and only get a handful of games, because that's what she's doing to people.
You know, I probably came up with the worst logic in the world for why I didn't pick Świątek to win this tournament. And that was because she'd already won the last two tournaments. I just sort of thought it had to end at some point.
I'd have gone with that.
And, you know, the Sunshine Double is a very hard thing to do. Not many players have done it in history. So I suppose there is some logic to that. But looking back on it now, her wins at the end of Indian Wells did not look like someone coming to the end of their winning streak. You know, she wasn't just getting over the line in matches in the same way that kind of Nadal was at the start of Indian Wells. And you sort of thought, okay, he might be able to keep this going to the end of the tournament, but someone might take him out. Świątek was in her absolute prime of this winning streak in Indian Wells, and she's carried it on into Miami. And it's pretty incredible that this has coincided with her ascension to world number one. It's almost like she's playing like this because she now is the world number one. It's like having that role has brought out just this extra element to her tennis, this extra confidence. And of course she was playing well before she got to world number one, but even more so now. And yeah, she is in such good form. 15 wins in a row now, stretching across three different tournaments. I think only Venus Williams, Bianca Andreescu, Maria Sharapova and Nicole Vidasova have been under 21 and come up with a winning streak like this in the last 22 years, since the turn of the century. You know, that is the sort of company that this streak is in. It's you know, it's amazing what we're watching right now. And as you said, so many of those wins are easy wins, you know, barely giving up games. She's head and shoulders at the moment above kind of everyone she's playing.
And against different types of player as well. I mean, if you think she beat Simona Halep last week, and then last night she's beaten Petra Kvitova, who's going out there swinging, and she just can handle these. She can get it back, she can retrieve, and then she can turn the tables and inject. It's similarly breathtaking to what we described Alcaraz as, and yet she's doing it with the target on her back of being world number one now. And those two, I mean, look, it may only be an isolated period of time, but they look suddenly like they're about to dominate the circuit. It's amazing to watch.
Yeah, they do. So Świątek now faces Jessica Pegula in the semi-finals. Pegula, the beneficiary of Paula Badosa's retirement yesterday in their quarterfinal, at two consecutive day session matches where a player retired trailing 4-1 in the opening set. It was a downer of a day in Miami, wasn't it? It was a real, you know, balloon popping moment.
And I think there was probably enough tennis so that ticket holders wouldn't have got money back. I mean, I don't exactly know the policy there, but that was tough for ticket holders yesterday. And odd that they both happened at exactly the same point, 4-1 in the first set for both matches. It was all just bad. But yeah, Pegula's really consistent. And Catherine, I know you have a thing about grown-ups, players who are grown-ups, and Pegula strikes me as one. She's smart. She can talk about a lot of different topics. She's level-headed, and she takes that onto court. She's not distracted by things. She just gets on with her game. And that game is tricky, I think, for players, because there's not many who hit the ball just so flat. And that with that trajectory, I think it surprise his opponents. And I think this is her fifth 1000 event quarterfinal since the start of last season. That's the most on the WTA tour, and you know, she's into her second semi-final now. So yeah, she's really just made so many strides, and she's never been American number one officially because of the quirk that happened in the rankings last season. Kenin kept that spot, even though sort of in the live rankings she was down at about 80. She kept her number one spot, and Pegula didn't get it after the Australian Open this year because of Danielle Collins' amazing run to the final. So she's never quite had it, but I think if she were to win the title this week, she'd get very, very close again. So that's kind of in play for her, and I think she's motivated by that.
Unfortunately, though, she does have Świątek the Destroyer next. The other semi-final in the top half of the draw is Bencic against Osaka. Now, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I'm already dreaming about the Osaka-Świątek final and it being the start of the rivalry that I so desperately crave. I'm dreaming about it. I'm wanting it. I'm sure it's going to happen. David, though, has got other ideas.
Well, I picked Bencic in the newsletter that we do every week to win the tournament this week after my initial pick of last week went out in the first round. That was Leila Fernandez. It was so long ago, it feels like another month altogether. But to be honest, I kind of went for Bencic because everybody else had gone for other people, and also because her points tally was quite good. Plus, I always like to have a look at somebody's road through a tournament, and she'd had a Świątek-like road through the tournament, winning matches all in straight sets without losing many games at all. And that was always a bit of a sign to me that somebody's just banging form. And I mean, look, I'm just looking up her head-to-head against Osaka here. It's 4-1 in her favour. That's quite something. And the last one was 3 years ago at the US Open when Osaka was the defending champion, but 7-5, 6-4. And she's won the last four meetings. The only one that Osaka's won was 2013. So there's something there. And I think it's counteracted by the fact that Osaka just looks in blistering form at the moment. But she is a player who can look incredible and then hit a bit of an obstacle and kind of go off the ball pretty dramatically as well. So I think, you know, if Bencic plays well, it could be at the very least an interesting test of where Osaka is.
It's the absolute nightmare match for trying to make a prediction because of what you've said, David, because the tennis I've seen from Osaka, other than Świątek, has been the best in this tournament. Just the sweetness of the ball striking reminded me of Andy Murray's tweet during the Australian Open. Does anyone hit the ball cleaner from the baseline than Osaka? I think she's combined for almost 70 winners in her last two matches against Alison Risk and then Danielle Collins, who was injured, I think, in that match. But then you've got the head-to-head, and 4-1, I mean, it's sort of 3-0 on the pro tour. That's enough of a head-to-head to suggest there's a match-up problem for Osaka. But all of those wins were, as you said, in 2019 for Bencic. And maybe it was just, you know, a match-up that year that really bothered Osaka. So I'm fascinated to see them play again today. But Bencic can rush Osaka, I think. She can take the ball really early, step into it, take Osaka's time away. But basically, I've just been reveling in watching Osaka play tennis this week like this again. It's the best she's played certainly since last year's Australian Open, and it's just wonderful to see.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I found it really uplifting watching Naomi Osaka this week. It doesn't feel, I know what you're saying, David, about, you know, she can look a dream and then it can go, but she hasn't felt on the edge of that to me this week. She's felt right in her comfort zone. I haven't felt nervous or anxious watching her, thinking, you know, this is frail in some way. It's felt just not quite comfortable, but it's just been really enjoyable and comforting somehow to watch her play this kind of tennis. And yeah, I I'm I'm excited for the Osaka-Bencic match, but I have already decided that Osaka and Świątek are starting their rivalry in the final of this tournament. And I shout, did you just roll your eyes at me, Matt?
No, I was looking up their head-to-head, which meant I had to look up at my screen.
That's going to be my new eye-rolling defence.
A sentence with, is that you eye-rolling and it not to be directed at me?
I'm the eye-roller around here, folks. What is their head-to-head, Matt?
I am so on board this being a rivalry.
Great. Please, what's the head-to-head? I can't think of any matches.
They played in Canada 2019 when Osaka won 7-6, 6-4.
Okay. So that was before Świątek had won the French Open, very much before Świątek was the force that she is now. And it was still a close-ish match. Okay. Yeah. Right. My appetite is further whetted. It's going to happen, folks. I don't really understand Belinda Bencic as a tennis player, just as a PS. She can be amazing, and it makes so much sense when she's brilliant and winning gold medals, and then she can disappear. Like, I don't even remember when or to whom she lost in Indian Wells. Yeah. We didn't mention it. I didn't, you know, pick her out in the draw. I don't know.
This is classic Bencic. I'm not reading anything into this whatsoever. This is what Bencic can do when she's playing well. We know this. But I'm not then expecting her to be doing this throughout the rest of the season. But these isolated weeks, she can be absolutely one of the best players in the world.
She's another one who said she struggled with long COVID as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the first few months of this year, she was really struggling. So I think it's hopefully a good sign that she's coming out of that now.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Okay. Sorry that I've written you off, Belinda, against Naomi Osaka. I think it will be a good match. I do. I'm looking forward to it. Couple of other things. Well, one main thing to wrap up from Miami so far. Our last podcast, we talked about Victoria Azarenka and her packing it in and marching off court, frankly, against Linda Fruvitova, the 16-year-old phenom. Who did Fruvitova eventually lose to in Miami?
She lost to Badosa.
Ah, yes. And then Badosa, of course, retired with illness against Pegula. Well, we said we would await eagerly Azarenka's comments, statement about what happened in that match. And she did release a statement. She said the following, "I shouldn't have gone on court today. The last few weeks have been extremely stressful in my personal life. That match took so much out of me, but I wanted to play in front of a great audience as they helped me pull through my first match. I wanted to go out there and try, but it was a mistake. I hope to take a break and be able to come back. I'm sorry to the fans for what happened, as you were great to cheer for me. It was the only reason I decided to step on the court. I always look forward to the pressure and challenge of competition today. But today it was too much. I have to and will learn from this. I would like to congratulate my opponent and wish her the best of luck in this tournament and beginning of her professional career." So good on her for saying that and owning it. I'm sorry that she's struggling so much. I think it's understandable. I don't know if the personal life stresses that she refers to are to do with, you know, being a Belarusian athlete, but I'd be surprised if that wasn't at least a factor. I wish she had apologised to her opponent. I know she says at the end, "I'd like to congratulate my opponent," but I felt like she deserved an apology as well, really. But apart from that, basically good on her for saying that.
Mm. Yeah, she shook hands with her opponent, actually. We just didn't catch it on the main feed, but it was still... not a good look, but Anna, like you say, I'm glad she's come back to it. Just one other quick thing I'd also wanted to come back to from Miami was Simon's report on the ground of how he's found this tournament versus Crandon Park. Had quite a lot of emails from listeners who, just from a fan perspective, have been and said they prefer the Hard Rock Stadium. They felt it much more easier to get around, to go between courts, and they've enjoyed the experience. It feels, certainly from a fan perspective, as though those that have been anywhere are quite enjoying it.
Lovely. Oh, to be a tennis fan in Miami right now. That sounds great.
shall we just quickly do a pronunciation corner on Azarenka's opponent that we've been saying?
Oh, we should, shouldn't we?
Because you had a voice note from Daniela Hantikova. I had a message from a guy called John Mastrini, who does the WTA social media. He's a big pod listener and Fulham fan as well, and crucially for us here, Czech. And he says Fruvertova, with the stress on the second syllable, the to being short like toggle, and the var being long like the var in Jamie Vardy, which I thought was a fun way of helping us there. So
hang on, is that the same as how Daniela says it though?
Daniela puts a bit of a sort of
e. There's a bit of an e sound in there, isn't there?
Well, this one, I have to say, is even tough for me. And I've done this already like 10 times. So here you go. Linda Fruhvirtová. She's pretty much like, you say the H, but not really. And go slow, because even for me, it's hard. So Linda Fruhvirtová. Got it? Let me know if you need more help, but good luck to us.
She says, go slow, because even for me, it's hard. Great.
Fruhvirtová.
Fruvirtová. Okay. Thank you to Daniela and to, what was the name of your Fulham fan friend?
John.
John. Thank you, John.
How many Fulham fans are in tennis?
Too many, David. Too many.
American Andrews are Fulham fans.
Everyone's claiming to be a Fulham fan. It's glory supporting, Matt.
I'm a fan of the Albion fans.
Okay, so wrapping up Miami. Joe Salisbury is going to be the doubles world number one next week. That's really great for him, isn't it? Yeah. And I'd particularly like to mention this because while I was at LAX airport last week, one incident was at LAX and one was on an escalator in Heathrow on the way to arrivals. I got independently approached by both of Joe Salisbury's parents to say hello and to tell me that they're big fans of the podcast.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Wow. I wasn't expecting that. I did not know that story. That's amazing.
Yes. To Joe Salisbury's
Mr. and Mrs. Salisbury.
They both introduced themselves as, respectively, Joe Salisbury's dad and Joe Salisbury's mum, which I thought was just lovely. And they were both delightful. Yeah. So there we go. Congratulations to Joe Salisbury and his parents who have raised a world number one player. Yeah. Pretty amazing.
And I do love the fact that it's such a work in progress for many years, isn't it, to get to this point and to build that ranking and to stay with the same partner, Rajiv Ram, who's, I think, going to be number two in the world as well. You know, they've become a fabulous pair and they've just had to build that from the ground up. And you know, he's done that without being a big-name singles player who's moved into doubles. He's made himself a doubles specialist, and it's a magnificent achievement. It really is.
There was a nice piece from Simon pointing out kind of the struggles Joe Salisbury had to go through when he was younger, quite a lot of health issues. It was absolutely no guarantee that he would make it as a pro player. And the fact that he's world number one now, I think he's in his late 20s, Joe Salisbury, which sounds, you know, it sounds like the latter half of your career. But Simon Briggs pointed out that he's the second youngest player, I think, in the top 20 in doubles. You know, so many doubles players are in their 30s. I think only Matej Pavic is younger than Salisbury of the top players. So, I mean, Rajiv Ram's quite a bit older, isn't he? But if that partnership can stay together, if he can find another partner over the next 4 or 5 years, there's no reason, I don't think, why Salisbury can't sort of continue being a top player for many more years to come. Really, really impressive. And if Medvedev gets to number one, we'll have three new world number ones on Monday, which because that's when Świątek will officially get there, Salisbury and Medvedev as well.
Mm. Like it. like that potential stat. Away from Miami, a couple of bits and bobs for you. We marked your card earlier in the week that both Dominic Thiem and Stan Wawrinka were launching comebacks at a challenger event in Marbella. It didn't go brilliantly. Stan Wawrinka lost to Ilias Ima in his opening match, and Dominic Thiem lost to someone honestly I've never heard of, and then announced that he's got COVID. I know obviously comebacks, you know, you've got to keep your expectations low, but that's not gone brilliantly for either of them, has it?
No, I mean, I think Wawrinka, I would have expected him to lose that match. I think Elias Ima has been playing really well, actually, the last few months. That's not a bad loss, for sure. For Thiem, I mean, the worst thing is he made his comeback after so long, and they dressed him in those horrendous shorts that Adidas are using at the moment.
Made him look like he'd soiled himself.
Yeah, literally.
Stitch up.
I tuned in with him 5 love down in the first set, and I was really fearing the worst. I thought, oh my God, can Thiem not play? Is he in pain? All of that. I started watching, and he actually reeled off 3 straight games and was hitting amazing shots. And I thought, oh, okay, this is more like it. This is quite comforting. He was up against Pedro Cachin from Argentina, about 230 in the world, I think. Clearly, Thiem was just extremely rusty. You know, I think even when Thiem's at his best, he can sometimes make quite a lot of errors, and he did. You know, he just made so many errors in parts of that match. He was rusty. But actually, I came away from that before the COVID announcement. I came away from that thinking that was positive for Thiem because he wasn't injured. He didn't appear to be in pain, and he actually entered Marrakesh next week. You know, a sort of positive sign that he was feeling physically okay. And that, to me, is the most important thing. As long as he's physically okay, I think he can make progress if the pain's gone. But yeah, it's a reminder, the depth of tennis. You know, you can't just rock up and expect to win after 9 months out. You know, these guys can play down at 200 in the world even. And this guy had a lovely drop shot, and yeah, it was a reminder, really. And I think Wawrinka pointed that out on Twitter as well.
Yeah. I mean, I so desperately wish them both the best for their careers, for their comebacks. I feel slightly differently about them. For Wawrinka, it feels like it would be, you know, a great bonus if he were able to get back to some kind of level. Thiem feels, I feel a certain sense of injustice for Dominic Thiem about what's happened to him since he reached the highest peak of his career. And it would be, gosh, it would be desperately sad if he doesn't make it back. So wish them both very well. Matteo Berrettini has had a minor operation on his hand. He withdrew ahead of the tournament in Miami. He's posted a smiling surgical selfie. Well, not selfie, just photo, which is sort of par for the course now when you have an operation, so that when you win a tournament 2 weeks later, broadcasters can flash up the picture of you in a hospital bed and go, oh my goodness, look how far they've come. So wish Matteo Berrettini well as well, as do we to Elina Svitolina, who said that she's taking a break from tennis. She said it's been an extremely difficult couple of months mentally and physically. She's got an issue with her back. She says she's been observing with unbearable pain in her heart what's happening in Ukraine. She needs rest. She'll be missing the Billie Jean King Cup and a few of her favourite tournaments in Europe, which must be, you know, a gut-wrenching decision for her. When you think of, you know, some of my best memories of Svitolina are her playing in Rome. I just think of her as somebody that comes alive at that tournament. So she hasn't confirmed that she'll miss that, I don't think, but it seems potentially unlikely. Gosh, we really wish her well and all the Ukrainian players. There was a gut-wrenching post from Lisa Serenko earlier this week, wasn't there, about her having to make the decision to leave Ukraine, and she just didn't know where to go. It was desperately sad. And unfortunately, we are we are going to have to end on another even more desperately sad note. There's somebody we want to pay tribute to that died this week, who's been tremendously important to this podcast, and I think particularly to David personally. And we're all still reeling, really, from this news. David, tell us about Richard Moore.
Yeah, Richard, we heard yesterday, had died on Monday. And Richard, if you don't know him and his work, he was a journalist for The Guardian, The Sunday Times, The Scotsman, in the sport of cycling. Mainly, that was what he sort of specialised in, although he got in touch with me a few times when he was asked to write pieces about Andy Murray in Scotland. And sometimes I remember he had questions about Andy Murray's injury situation after that press conference in Australia, and he got in touch with me. And the reason he got in touch with me is because we'd got to know each other over the last 7 or 8 years because of the similarities in our journeys with the podcasts that we both are involved with. I mean, mainly, honestly, it was me approaching him because I wanted to understand the journey that he and his co-founders and co-hosts, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb, had been on with the cycling podcast, because they'd had such incredible success. And I wanted to get some insight. And he was so generous with his time to me. He would take phone calls from me, he would answer questions on email. I think I've been in touch with him every year since then, just to update and to find out where they are with things. And the reason we now run the Friends of the Tennis podcast is because they run the Friends of the Cycling podcast, and they did so successfully. And it was just an inspiration, really, to me and to all of us. And it has guided so much of what we do. Richard, same age as me, wonderful author as well. He wrote several books that people have been paying tribute to over the last 24 hours. The Dirtiest Race in History, the Ben Johnson, Carl Lewis, Seoul Olympics 100-meter final. Slaying the Badger was something that our good friend Stephen Farrow, who's high up at Tennis Australia, mentioned to me yesterday was a book that he'd read, and it was just the book that he takes with him as a memory and as an inspiration from the sport of cycling in so many ways. And it's just desperately, desperately sad news. I feel so much for all the people who work and are involved with the cycling podcast. The outpouring of tributes and emotion to Richard tell you everything about what he meant to people. And he's got a young family, and just so sad to hear that news. And I'll be eternally grateful, to be honest, for the guidance and the help and the time that he gave me.
Yeah, our podcast would not be where it is or what it is without Richard. And it's desperately sad. And our thoughts are very much with everyone, well, his family, obviously, but everyone that worked with him. He had a big impact on a lot of people, and a lot of people really reeling from that. So thank you, Richard, for everything you did for this pod. That's it for this week. We'll be back on Monday, of course, rounding up Miami, a podcast when I'll at least know what stage of the tournament we're at, folks. And maybe even a little look ahead to the clay court season and the fact that Świątek and Alcaraz are probably going to win everything. So that'll be next week. We have got Friends podcasts coming to you as well. We've got two listener question specials coming your way in the next couple of weeks. The questions have come in. They're excellent. You always do us really proud with those. So they'll be recording soon, and they'll be with you on the Friends feed in the next few weeks. We have our weekly mascot, Hines Ward, named after an American football player that massive American football fan David Law has never heard of. And he's wearing a Seahawks hoodie again.
By way of protest.
You fraud, David. Hines Ward is a lovely 12-year-old Beagle Chow mix owned by Karen. So thank you very much, Karen, and thank you to Hines Ward and your lovely face for being our mascot. I've got Carter, David's got Darwin. Matt's got Gerald. I think I picked Alcaraz and Osaka to win the tournaments. So, Carter, we're feeling okay about that. Billie Jean, who's at daycare right now, has Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Chris Albert Lee and Kyle Weingartner are our executive producers. And Matt, we have shout outs.
Yes. I need to start with a little apology. Do you remember Zug from the last shout out?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got told off by my mum. That is not how you pronounce that, apparently. It is Zug.
Zug. Ooh.
I mean, okay. How was I supposed to know? But apparently I should have just sort of learnt that pronunciation by osmosis or something, being surrounded by my German-speaking parents. Anyway.
You've disappointed your parents, David. Mm. Matt, rather.
Anyway, that will come in handy for a later pronunciation in the shout-out section, so I just thought I would get that in there.
Oh.
We start with Nadia Hamya in Paris.
Hello, Nadia. In Paris? Oh, how fitting. We are currently looking into accommodations for our tennis podcast stint in Paris for the French Open in a couple of months.
Thanks, so, Nadia.
Paris on the brain. Thank you very much, Nadia. Lovely name.
We also have Saga Sriramagiri from Hoboken, ooh, just across the river from Manhattan.
Oh, I have a friend that lives in Hoboken.
Do you?
Mm, it's in New Jersey, isn't it?
Yeah.
You've met him, Dan the cameraman.
Oh, yeah, Dan.
That takes the amazing
photographer
pictures
as well. Yeah,
yeah, he lives in Hoboken.
I've seen him sporting a tennis podcast t-shirt in the past.
Yes, great spot. Thank you very much for your support. Well done for living in Hoboken.
And the last shout out today is Layla, as in, and I'm quoting Layla. As in Matt's wonderful 2021 rendition. Layla's words.
Is it spelt the same?
No, so this is Layla, L-E-I-L-A, whereas the song is L-A-Y-L-A.
I'm having deja vu here. This is the same conversation we had, isn't it?
But Layla is in Luzern in Switzerland, which I now know how to pronounce, I think. She's an expat
like
Brit.
Like a Lutz, like the ice skating jump, a Lutz, rather than loose, like Lucifer. Well, on that note.
Thanks, Layla.
Thanks, Layla.
For being our friend.
Matt's obviously not going to be forthcoming with another rendition of Layla, so we'll just have to...
You can't improve on perfection.
We'll just have to wheel out the clip of that, which one of our wonderful listeners did a rendition of for us, didn't they?
Even
mix
play
down
instead of our music, Catherine.
Sold. See you next week.
Layla, you got me on my knees, Layla.
Oh, yes.
It's the first time I've ever heard Matt sing.
It is. What a note to finish on.
Oh, God.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.